You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
It's a great pleasure to have Balázs here, who usually resides in Vilnius, with frequent excursions to places east, like Ukraine and... Can you get into Belarus?
Yes.
Good, good. And Belarus. And it's great to have Andrew also here, who's a vice president for programs at the Carnegie Endowment in Das Kapital. And this is great that everyone has come to this conversation. Essentially, we thought we would do something such as the following. Balázs Jarabik has begun, with some support from the Open Society Foundations, putting out a series of kind of analytical briefs as to the state of reform, public policy transition, and the like in Ukraine. And the most recent one, we don't have copies here, but it's all available online. Oleksandr Sushko, the chair of the International Renaissance Foundation in Kiev. Sasha and Balázs are frequently in touch, and I thought it would be interesting to have Sasha respond in a somewhat debate-oriented form, not point-counterpoint, say, but something that offers a bit of productive friction as a means to edification. Maybe, Balázs, you could present some of the highlights of the report as you understand them, as you understand the situation in Ukraine. Sasha can respond. We can have a dialogue therein, and then we could just open it up to a conversation about what is transpiring in Ukraine today. As I think most people know, Ukraine is... on planet Earth today, potentially the most significant place in the eyes of George Soros. Okay. It plays, not in the eyes of everyone, but it plays, Katsi, why don't you come sit here? It plays an certainly outsized role in what George is spending his time on. I think many of you know he's been there 6 times. In the last 16 months. Michael, yourself, how many times have you been to Ukraine in the last 16 months?
Not once.
6 times in the last 6 months. So the level of commitment on the part of George Soros, and by extension all of us who work with George Soros on the region we now call Eurasia, has been not insignificant. George will go there for the 25th or 20th? 25th anniversary. Is that silver or is that diamond?
Yes.
Silver. The 25th anniversary of the foundation in November. You're all warmly welcome. You have to pay your own way, but I think the event itself is on the 13th, the Friday the 13th.
13th and 14th depends mostly 13th.
Okay, there you have it. So without further ado, I'd like to turn things over to Balázs, who may want to spend, say, 7 to 10 minutes providing a nice overview that Sasha will then respond to critically.
Great. Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here. And you know, I haven't been to New York for 10 years. I was 15 years ago, I was at Columbia as a human rights advocate and program visiting fellow at the Columbia. So it's extremely a pleasure to return after so many years. A couple of things. I think for the background, I used to live 6 years in Kyiv. Helped to build up the biggest civil society support program funded by USAID. And we have been doing a lot of work with IRF together. So it's also kind of, for me, kind of almost like being at home, if I may. And I'm still working for a USAID fund, the biggest USAID fund, the civil society project in Belarus. I have been a long-time person in Rwanda, but for some reason they're giving me a visa now. I guess they want to know what we're doing. So a couple of things, you know, you can indeed, the Ukrainian Reform Monitor is online, and essentially we published a month ago the first assessment. It's prepared by Ukrainian authors. There's only one scholar among them. We were trying to put together a group of practitioners or insiders and trying to keep the necessary fact-checking, you know, quality, editing, and the essential integrity of the piece because, you know, when it comes to accountability, like we want to kind of present a, not a virtual but a real picture as much as possible. And there's two things around it, and I'm going to get to the points. A, we were pleasantly surprised to see. I thought, like, we thought at Carnegie that we were, how to say, we're more critical toward the Ukrainian government than actually this assessment was showing when it comes to the reforms. And second, I 2 days ago, I've been to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee with senior staffers who told me that this is an extremely good product and they're using it to build a, to draft a new bill for economic assistance.
Wow.
For, so I think it's a great fit. I was very surprised. It was, I didn't even ask for it. It was just, they was just telling us. I mean, I was there with somebody from Carnegie. And I think it's like show the value of the process and the publication. So, which I thought it would be very important to kind of have something like that. So we monitor the progress of reforms in four areas: political reform and judiciary, security, economy, and energy, and decentralization. So very quickly, obviously the glass is half full, half empty, depends how you see. I would say that the glass is like 30-35% full and 60-65% empty. Why? When it comes to the political reforms, I think it's immensely important that the post-Maidan government managed to rebuild its legitimacy, political legitimacy. Why elections and also why mostly legislative action? But here comes, you know, the big problem is the judiciary. The judiciary, and it's very little change. Essentially, there are change in figures. Like Shokin is a new prosecutor general. It's a shocking news. But it's loyal to Poroshenko, and essentially that's why he's there. So it's very little change. But it comes to, you know, the judges. So judiciary is a big thing, also because I think the political legitimacy is now very much threatened by the impunity. And what we have been seeing, there has been no proper investigation of any of the violent events of Ukraine, which is slowly but surely catching up with the government, unfortunately. Okay, so, you know, I'm talking about the violence of the Maidan, then Odessa, and you see Mukachevo, and with the abundance of weapons, this has been become a very, and the poverty, the increasing poverty, and the social, potential social unrest, this has become a serious challenge. Security. The security situation is also something which, you know, it has the most visible success. And I'm emphasizing visible because it's visible of the new police, right? The new police reform is something which so far has been the case study of how the reforms could be pushed forward. It's very much aided and pushed by that minority, which I call it the new Ukraine is in a minority in the government, but nevertheless they are there. So they are the ones who prepare the legislations and the new structure. Western donors are very much pushing the envelope here. You know, one of the reasons, there are two kind of anecdotal evidence for that, the new Ukraine police has American uniform, I mean black uniforms, because it was donated by the United States, and cops here have black uniforms, and the cars coming from Japan, and their flashlights are only blue because of that, which is, you know, and the flashlights are on all the time. It's a new Georgian kind of style, but it's, again, it's very visible. I think the speed of the reform is fantastic because original plan was only for Kyiv, and now it's like 55-60% of the Ukrainian territory is covered. Here, the glass is half empty because of the military. I mean, the Donbas war was largely fought by the volunteer battalions, which kind of has become a problem as well. And although Poroshenko changed four times the Minister of Defense, there is no change in the Chief of Staff. And Ukraine problems, as we have been always emphasized at Carnegie, are not weapons. Are the management, the military, and the management, as well as the human qualities of the generals. And there's very little change in there. There is a lot of clashes in the political elites because of that. But, you know, here comes the problem with Poroshenko's manual governance. Once loyalty is the most important, if not the only quality, you know, I think loyalty, one thing, but the merit needs to be coming up as well. economy and energy, I think what we have been seeing is not a reform, but a really a big success of an agreement with the private donors and creditors, which a few people essentially expected that this is going to happen. That's number one. And number two, there is also a legislative work is laid down successfully. And also, I consider the biggest success the new transparency of the energy sector, particularly in the gas. This also could be a very good case study of how the new Ukraine can move forward. This is a sector where the European Union has been spending significant time, and they had significantly accumulated knowledge about the sector. So here, when the Ukrainians come, claiming something, the Ukrainians said, "No, no. We actually having enough experience and data and evidence that this is not the case." Why I want to say this? Because I think the new Ukraine does not need only our support, but need not only the trust, which they're always asking for, but need the verification. I'm always quoting Ronald Reagan here, "Trust but verify," which is coming actually from a Russian proverb, "Doveryay na proveryay." That's what I think the new Ukraine or the reforms forward would need more. And last but not least, the decentralization. It's also technically, I think, it's one of the most advanced reform. Also here, because of the Western pressure, the Ukraine authorities finally moved forward with the decentralization bill, the constitutional changes, which are part of the Minsk agreement. But the most important thing for the decentralization is, because of the lack of resources, Kiev cannot continue with essentially the subsidies, right? The Donbas war is a kind of symbolic. It has a symbolic characterization or characteristic itself. It's the end of resources, because that was possible. These Soviet industrial, giants were impossible only with heavy subsidies, and that subsidies were going ratcheting up in the past 10 years, and Ukraine doesn't have the resources any longer for that. So what we see is a rebuilding of Kiev relationship with the region, with the notion that Ukraine is going to remain minus Crimea, territorial integrity is going to be intact. And it's going to be very important by the decentralization to see this rebuilding Kiev relationship with the regions. There are two things which are important. A, which is already done, the borrowing. Cities, can be borrowed now. Obviously, they need to have the economic conditions for that, but technically, by law, it's possible. And the second is a local taxation. And we're just working on a new update, which is going to come in end of September, beginning of October. The tax reform is something promising to be big. This the government, and this is also the work of Finance Minister Jareska, they're proposing a tax reform for 20% for four major tax rates. And if it's going to come forward, essentially, that's going to help aid the decentralization and also going to be a big help for the entrepreneurs, because unfortunately, the Poroshenko government or the Yatsenyuk government continued the Yanukovych government practice of pressuring entrepreneurs a lot. Last but not least, and I'm finishing up now, all the reforms needs the context as well. And I think when you're putting the reforms into the context of growing poverty and the potential social unrest, the situation with the weapons and the battalions, the increasingly high criminal rate. Only the murder rate in Kiev went up by 8 times since the Maidan. You can't find these statistics online, unfortunately, or fortunately. It depends on viewpoint. I think it's not necessarily a bad thing. Too much transparency, as Ivan Krastev teaches us, also may kill. That kind of creates a dangerous and potentially very turbulent situation. The good news is that it seems that Russia really gave up on the Donbas. It's also whether a good news or a bad news is a question, but there is no Russian aggression forthcoming. At least now it seems it's not the case. Also because even the Russians, I think, they kind of think that now the internal cohesion issues of Ukraine is going to be the most important. Thank you.
So before Sasha, George, just to let you know, so Balazs, the Arabic, works with the Carnegie Endowment. Andrew here is vice president for programs at the endowment, and we are supporting Carnegie to put together a series of analytical briefs on Ukraine. And so the idea was that Sasha would critique or offer some element of feedback on the first analytical brief that Balazs just summarized.
Thank you, Balazs. That's what very closely. Watching your project and how you proceeding. As for the foundation, what we do is also a kind of combining of helping those in the government who want to be helped, but at the same time supporting a variety of civil society initiatives, including those who are quite critical on the government. And sometimes the government feel itself not comfortable when seeing us supporting them in some substantial elements and also supporting watchdogs in many initiatives who are very critical. But this is a very simple explanation of that, is that we do not support any government. We support only reforms, and if the government is really willing to do some reforms, we may be helpful for them on conditional basis. So I appreciate very much this intellectual initiative, because the Western audiences need very much comprehensive and competent information and analysis on what's going on in Ukraine. And we are in favor of putting together Ukrainian expertise and Carnegie's expertise, and also Carnegie's capacities to communicate the research outputs. So we hope that to be on right direction, I think. Then on the substance and on the reform agenda as such, yes, we may agree and accept the point that on the glass, half empty, half full. However, I think that the most important is to the identification of the fact that in Ukraine we have a specific case when the civil society energy is the main insurance against imitation of reforms. And this what gives us real hope for further progress, even under these circumstances which Balazs described. We have continuous efforts by reformist part of the government, and these reformists are not representative of one or particular factions. They are in different areas of policy work, and the civil society groups. We have supported government in a way, providing them consultancy and expertise through the project we called strategic advisory groups in many areas. We also contributed to the government's capacity to coordinate the process of reforms by initiated set up of the National Reform Council as an informal or semi-formal institution to serve as a platform for dialogue for reforms. We considered it very substantial. Why? Because unlike such cases as Georgian case or some other cases, we do not have a system where some political force or politician has a monopoly for actions. No one. So even after the victory of Poroshenko as a president with 52% of votes and very diverse, I would say, after parliamentary election, which gave no monopoly for power to any political force. The only way to ensure reforms progress is a consensus building within the political class. And there is no, because there is no single force which can impose a will on the others. So the only way is to have a dialogue and to agree on something. And here there is both strengths and weakness of Ukraine. Strengths, because as soon as you reach a consensus, you may go ahead with certain support and with certain, I would say, good practice of decision making, on consensus building, etc. The weakness on the other side, that there is no guarantee that in each particular case you will reach this consensus. And finally, we have that the situation where some substantial reforms are going ahead, while the others are either stuck or very slow. And that is why the picture is really not homogeneous. You do not have cases when you may see that this is a particular success stories. But the overall picture is not, it doesn't give us ground to say the overall picture is already a success story. We may identify specific success stories, but the whole reformist process is far from being complete. If you are inside or if you are closely monitoring the process, that's a visible, evident signs of the progress in many areas. I just give you example of today. Today, the Ministry of Finance launched a website on state expenditures. So all the expenditures, including procurement, whatever, national, regional, sectoral level, should be available. If you wish to know how this public money is spent, you may just search and see on the date basis or the agency basis, etc., how public funds are spent. This is a revolutionary change for Ukraine, where the major source of corruption was lack of transparency. Nobody knows where those money are. And so this is not just a legal act, because the legal act was adopted a few months ago, but now this is already implementation. Certainly this website is not fully operating since, so the full operation will come in a couple of months. But today they launched, and many things are already available. So this is how it goes. Then you mentioned police reform. Really, unlike in Georgia, in Ukraine it's not possible to change all the police within one day or 1 month. This is a huge number of officers, and there is a need for, if you want to replace it with a new one, you need to educate them, to select them, to educate, to equip. And this is a gradual decision was taken a few months ago that it will go city by city, from the biggest to smaller, and now we have the police in operation in Kyiv, Lviv, and Odessa, and soon we will have it in Kharkiv, Lutsk, and some other cities. But total reform will take 2 years. 2 years. And this is only patrol police. We also need to reform criminal police and also the Ministry of Interior structure, which is also not reformed. So this is police reform is not the whole reform of Ministry of Interior. So this is a huge job. And the resistance in this case and many other cases is visible, because those old guys are losing their jobs. Prosecutor office reform. Yes, there is a controversy that Poroshenko, and this is my analysis on our leadership of the country. So Poroshenko is natural transitional figure. He is neither reformist nor blocking reform. So he is somewhere between. He tries to balance. He is afraid of losing control. This idea of losing control is a major fear of all Ukrainian leaders. And they are afraid if they introduce immediately full-fledged reform of prosecutor, of law enforcement, of judiciary, of everything, they may lose power. Because this free and not independent judiciary may be used against them. Certainly they violated something in their practical lives, And again, so this is a ambivalence which is determined by the ambivalence of their own personal and corporate history, these new leaders. So that is why we consider them as transitional figures. They need to ensure at least partial changes. And the prosecutor office is an example. There is a general prosecutor who is an old guy. There are a couple of deputy prosecutors who are new guys. And there is a continuous debate on how to proceed. The old guys tried to preserve some old rules, and new is against of that. So now, what after many months of stagnation of this reform, we have seen this month, finally they started selection of 700 new prosecutors, which have to be selected, then trained, they have practice, and then to replace others. But this is only 700, while the total personnel of the prosecutor office in more than 10,000. So this is about maybe 7% of the whole, but they need to start with something. And this would be a test case for the reformists in the prosecutor. If they succeed, like, for example, police reform succeeded, they will have chance to go ahead, because their political support by president is dependent on their ability to sell this reform to society, to politicians. And if politicians say that this is a kind of success, then they may support it more than before. Before they see, because they are in the position to find a better public performance. And here it's very much sensitive to him, what support, what not. And if something is going well, the better chance that they finally support and more political will is provided. So this is basically where we are now. I think that certainly now we have a local election process. The voting day will be 25th of October. And this local election provide not the best environment for, because there is a growing populism. The politicians are rather preoccupied on how they are perceived. They try to vote for growing social expenditures, and there is no money for these expenditures, as usually, yes. And unfortunately, the coalition is very heterogeneous, and there is already one populistic group already withdrawn from the coalition, and there is a risk then two other political parties may withdraw. And certainly there is not a good time for that. So I think that with regards the further steps, certainly there is a need for doing at the same time encouraging the government for real progress, and we have these signs of real progress, and the government must be encouraged not only for that Minsk II controversial draft of the constitution, but also for substantial things. But at the same time, there should be more coherent strategy of how to support these particular elements of reform, support reformers. And the police case was a brilliant one. It is a brilliant example of the partnership of different international actors, governments, international organizations, and foundations. And by the way, we were also there by supporting trainings for new policemen. So there is a way how the West and the international community may proceed in helping Ukraine not to waste this chance for changes. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you, Sasha. Balázs, if you don't have anything to respond to Sasha, then maybe we will open it up to some
questions. Yeah, I think we should.
Some questions. Can I just ask you one question, Sasha? For all those people who were made redundant on the patrol police side, was there reskilling, retraining? What kind of social efforts made?
Okay, according to the law, there are two basic things. All those who are supposed to be fired at certain point should be informed about this beforehand. This is according to the labor law. So they were informed at least several months before that. Then they have equal rights to apply. So there is no limitation for all police guys to apply to new police and to train and to be a part of that. So there is no approach like to say no exclusion for them or no lustration for these old policemen. So everybody has this chance, but there are few, I would say, as far as I know, there are just up to 5% finally in the new police, those who have experience in the old police. But they are. So hypothetically, there is a way for them also to be a part of this. But certainly, as far as it was in Georgia, for example, there is a social and then political cost of that. Because any substantial reform is supposed to multiply those who are not satisfied with the outcomes. And certainly there is, you can imagine, for example, what old traffic policemen, гаишники, who are still on the streets, not in the Kyiv, but outside, they are still working, but they understand that they may be fired very soon. So how much incredible, terrible stories you may hear from them about the new police. Mm-hmm. This is new police for them is infant terrible, something which all the evils of the world is concentrated there. So you may imagine that if someday, the most of them even don't try to apply. Why? Because there is absolutely different way of perform their job, and they understand that there is no way to bribe. And they really no way. So within these 2 months of new police in operation in Kyiv, there was no single complaint on the bribery. So this is unique for our country. And those guys, they understand that their operational culture is not possible to be adapted to that. Mm. So certainly there is such a thing. But I agree probably that government should be more, I would say, careful to suggest some ways of integration, but probably not on the positions where they were placed, some other job. Because certainly at this point we have much more complaints that somebody with a bad reputation is still working.
Great. Okay, so questions. Tanya, please.
I think it's fascinating to hear about the reforms.
Tanya, you just want to introduce yourself.
My name is Tanya. I work for the Eurasia Program and work closely with Sasha and National mm-hmm. Foundation. I just want to hear how you think the people are perceiving these reforms. Are they translating to the public? Are people experiencing an improved life? Do they appreciate the fact they don't have to bribe police? Does that make their life more difficult, perhaps? So do you feel like the support for the new government is building along with these successes, or is there a disconnect?
Very good question, because when I asked some of our European colleagues, what would be your criteria, how to assess success of reforms? And they said to me, that will be on the basis of public perception. If the people sees reform, that there is a reform. If people don't see, so there is no reform. Unfortunately, we still do not have this. Why? The most of reforms are not so much visible. For example, if you conduct trainings for prosecutors, people don't care about. Even if you open the website where somebody may see public procurement, for the most of people it doesn't work. Police, okay, there is 2 months, but only in Kyiv. Mm-hmm. Kyiv is something like 8% of the population, so within public opinion poll it will be just 8% of those who hypothetically may benefit from that. So at this particular point, if you look at the recent public opinion polls, there is no perception of the big progress of reforms.
There is a very fresh particular public opinion poll by the Democratic Initiative Foundation. They published it last week, just the day before we had the launch at the Carnegie of the Ukraine Reform Monitor. I tried to kind of, I don't have, unfortunately, this, but it's very, very telling. This particularly, like, how Ukrainians are seeing reforms. 67% of the Ukrainians do not see reforms, right? And I have to agree with here with the notion that, you know, it's mostly because of the economy is in a very bad shape. And now 80% of the Ukrainians, according to the UN data, which is $5 a day, are living in poverty. Right, so essentially, for many, Maidan did bring much worsening of the social economic situation. Now, when the pollsters were asking about Ukrainians why they think the social economic situation is worsening, it was very interesting because the government says it's because of the Russian aggression, right? And 30% of the Ukrainians think that it's because of the Donbas war. Mm-hmm. Fair enough, but 57% of the Ukrainians blaming the government. 57, the oligarchization of, the corruption first. Mm-hmm. 57, the corruption. 54, the oligarchization of the economy. Mm-hmm. And 47, the incompetence of the government. And then only 30%, the Donbas war. Which means, you know, the Ukrainians are pretty much aware of what is exactly happening in there, you know, in the country. At the same time, I think there is a lot of fear of the Third Maidan. You know, I was not in Kyiv, but I was watching the social networks just among my friends. What was the reaction on the third grenade attack? Mm-hmm. I mean, the grenade attack in the Rada, the decentralization vote, the constitutional vote, it was panic. You know, people really thought in the first moment that, you know, I did think that the police essentially and the military was reacting quite quickly and good. But at the same time, I didn't understand why they're 20-year-old conscripts at such a vote, you know. But also it was an important reaction of the society that they did not support it, those who were protesting, but they were supporting the police and the government and said this is not what you want. So there is an increasing level of fear, you know. And third, there is still this post-Maidan patriotism, which is very important, right? Which is, this is, you know, whether we like it or not, this is what we have, and that's kind of, we have to make it better. Our goal was to make a new Ukraine, right? So these are the kind of emotional framework for this. Now, I believe this is tremendously important to move and prolong this hope, right? This patriotic hope by essentially delivering. And my main problem, what I see, is that unfortunately the Ukrainian government, I compared it sometimes with the Western support, you know, we overpromising and under-delivering, underperforming. And it should be vice versa, because people are tired because of that as well, that they promised victories by so many times, right? And what is exactly victory in the current situation, right? So, like, emphasizing small steps in the communication, and I think if the government would essentially say, look, guys, we still have a lot to do, but this is what we do, you know, and the main sign for that should be or could be a reshuffling of the government, mm-hmm. which is in the works. And we'll see what's going to happen after the elections, obviously before the elections, no. And, you know, it's going to send a tremendous signal, a reshuffle, what kind of reshuffling of the government. You know, if opposition bloc Lyovachkin will be the prime minister, which I don't think so, that's one message. If Yulia Tymoshenko will be, that will be another message. Saakashvili won't be, but that would be another message. And if
you think it's impossible for Saakashvili to become prime minister?
I think it's nearly impossible. Nearly, but, you know, you never know, really. But I don't think everybody seriously considering that. At the same time, you know, like, he's interestingly saying what a lot of people think, right? That the corruption, and, you know, he came out, and, you know, I think he's positioning himself to a high. I mean, he has to leave Odessa. Yeah, it is what it is. Well, Odessa, he's pushing the envelope too hard by his PR action. He alienated a lot of people. Instead of building coalitions to over change, you know, it's very popular, obviously, because people like it, but it's a very populistic move. You know, like, he should build alliances because as a governor has very little mandate. an authority to enforcing reforms. Like, he was the president of Georgia, he had the authority. Here he does not have the authority. So essentially I call him like he could be used as an unleashed dog of reforms, you know, because like he's barking a lot because he does not have the authority. So that's what he could do. And in this, like, a vice prime minister opposition. Now, what I hope is, just returning to my thought, is that Yariskova will be the prime minister, because that would send, she's the only one who achieved something
the finance minister.
He achieved the victory, if you like, with the creditors, right? So that could send a message for the Ukrainian people that, okay, guys, we are serious, right? We are more serious than we may look sometimes. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, like, two things on the corruption. I think, and here what you said, I think, is important, that, you know, what really has changed under corruption is what we suspected, now we know. But it doesn't change the mechanisms, right? That's number one. The second is there are no real fight with the corruption at the government level. There's a control of corruption. And that's also like, you know, and you know, Yatsenyuk said at the Yalta European strategy, well, what I can do about the corruption as a prime minister. I mean, seriously, like publicly, it says a lot about the current situation.
Can I just ask quickly, you mentioned the Yalta European seminar. Donald Trump, who's a Republican candidate for president in the 2016 elections, was invited to the Yalta European Seminar. And he came in via telephone. Your thoughts on why Viktor Pinchuk thought that Donald Trump would be a figure who could speak to issues Ukrainian?
I can't speak on behalf of him.
Yeah, I don't know. The reasons, that was a video link. And it was video link, just I think that those who had some illusions maybe in Ukraine about Trump, they lost this illusion. Because we have Oleg Ляшко, for example, a brilliant analogy to him. So this is something which... I know that Americans who were in the audience were a little bit surprised and even frustrated with all this situation, because there were high-level guests. Fortunately, Victoria Nuland was not at this moment,
but she was
next day. She was next day, yes. Maybe this is an adventure to show that American political class is also not homogeneous, yeah? And it should not be idealized. Yeah? I don't know the reasons behind that.
I don't think Pinchuk is that subversive, but that would be interesting.
But he said very stupid things. I think that, and in a way that I am for Ukraine. These guys are pretending to be for Ukraine. This is Ukraine deserves everything, etc. So that was, he even was not prepared to this dialogue. So all the points were very general and very
fake.
Yeah.
The Yalta European strategy is 10 years old or 11 now. And it was always like delivering celebrities to Ukraine to talk about Europe, right? So Trump essentially fits into that. But when I was actually watching the video, and it was, you could see Pinchuk's face. I think he pretty quickly got into it.
He's going to have. They used the new Ukraine as a slogan.
Yeah.
How does that fly in Ukraine?
First of all, there is no one single uniformed understanding on what is new Ukraine, because for us, for George, we promote this idea as an identification of the difference from what was in the past, meaning that we have an energy of the civil society which is able to transform the country, and the civil society is a major element of the actor of changes, and also there is a essential will on the side of society, not just to criticize or to wait for something, but to participate. And this is participatory phenomena is unique for Ukraine. If you compare it to Ukraine of the past, but also if you compare it to the most of the neighboring countries. But for the others, yes, I think that this is a powerful message, and I see that this is a kind of the fashion to say about new Ukraine, without going into details. So I understand that maybe some high-level politician think something differently. But anyway, there is a constant reference to this verbal formula in the narrative. So this is a growing use of this narrative of new Ukraine in Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. If I may, six, 7 years ago, when we have been starting, and I have been starting to work in Ukraine, and was kind of thinking about what to do, how to revitalize civil society, which was essentially captured by the Yushchenko, by the post-Orange kind of apathy. Like, if these are the guys we were fighting for, then why are we doing this, right? So, and that was the concept which, for me, was a kind of a revitalization, and I think that could characterize the Ukraine, and that was responsibility. That first, we are not demanding rights from the government, but we're taking responsibility for our action and taking responsibility into our hands. And I think this is very much characterized the civil society development and movements before Maidan, which essentially lead to Maidan. These were the young guys, the new generation, which, again, rights and responsibility. And I think in the post-Soviet field, in the context, in the local context, like in Belarus and a couple of other places, they overemphasize rights and downplay responsibility. So that's number one. Number two is this new Ukraine is essentially the middle class, which is under tremendous pressure. As I mentioned, most of the middle class has become poor, and that's obviously pushing them into different consideration, right, and different action and all this. Despite of that, this new Ukraine, the crowdfunding, the participation, the level of those is just tremendous. But because of the poverty, the paternalistic attitudes and are kind of returning. And that's helping, essentially, a return of the oligarchs, because let's be honest, the new Ukraine is still the old one, right? And if the Yalta European strategy is symbolizing something, that's oligarch back in full in power, right? The new Ukraine is in there, that's a change, right? But it's still in a minority. And the essence by the reforms and by their role should be, this is, I think, the Western, the Western international community, you name it, main role to make sure that this new Ukraine can grow within, make sure that the oligarchs are kind of, we cannot not deal with the oligarchs. It is what it is. That's at this stage is structurally given, right? Because Poroshenko is an oligarch, but he was elected, right? The same kind of Yanukovych was also elected, but let's not get there. So there is a new Ukraine, but it's in a minority.
Now, I have one question for you that bothers me a lot, and that's the Minsk process.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think there's a real it has to be completed. Russia, I think, really wants to have the sanctions lifted, which is a very positive. But there are two ways that Russia can achieve that. And one is to abide by the Minsk agreement. But there's another way, and that is to make Ukraine fail. Because if that happens, it's very difficult to get the sanctions approved unanimously in Europe. And unfortunately, I built, I don't know whether you read my...
Yes, I did.
But I left that out of account in my writing. And I since had a meeting with some Russian politicians, influential. And I came to realization that that's their ambition is not necessarily to actually abide by it, but to make Ukraine fail to abide by it. So how does that stand?
Phew, it's a complicated question.
I mean, you need 300 votes.
Right. Well, first, I think Russia's main objective, and whether they want to see Ukraine as a failed state is more a tactic, right? But the main objective is keep controlling Ukraine. And one of the reasons why, I never seen Russia's action, Crimea particularly, like it's a start of slicing up Ukraine. And I also don't see that Donbas was started by Russia. It was started by as a revenge of Yanukovych, Efremov, Akhmetov, right? Which went out of control with Russian aid, obviously, right? And we wouldn't talk about this if the Russian military, you know, wouldn't step in. So, you know, but it was fundamentally an internal development of Ukraine, right? Again, like, let's leave Crimea out. And Crimea was, you know, a gross overreaction on something. You know, the Russians were looking some kind of reassurance after the post-Maidan government, which the post-Maidan government was way too busy to think about what the Russians want, to be very frank, right? So the Russians stepped in their own way. You know, they started this. There was also one moment which I think was key in the Maidan period, which I'm happy to share, and most of the people, I don't think they realized that, you know, the shooting was on Thursday, Europeans Friday, Yanukovych fled Friday night, Tymoshenko came out to Saturday, right? And Saturday evening, she went to the Maidan on wheelchair and high heels, mm-hmm. right? And Monday, she was supposed to fly to Moscow. Mm-hmm. She didn't get the mandate, obviously, after she was booed, and the Russians get the message, she's supposed to meet with Putin. Mm-hmm. Wednesday, the little green man went out in Simferopol, was Sevastopol, right? So the sequencing of the event was telling me that if she would able to go, maybe she would able to get a deal, maybe it's a different story. It's a big, big if, and it didn't happen. You know, it's a separate story that how come that the Russian embassy could not reach those like Poroshenkos, the Kurchinovs, who they must have a normal communication channel. If they're not, that speak about the incompetence of the Russian embassy. But that's for the start. I think now the Russians see that Ukraine is, you know, first of all, they're surprised that the Ukraine respond, that's for sure, right? At the same time, I think the Russians are saying that the Ukraine internal issues are really much overwhelming, right? The Western pressure is on them and sanctions, but there's not enough Western money. There's not enough Western support, right? And Ukraine kind of barely surviving. So there is no point to keep continuing Ukraine pressure over the Donbas. So I think the Russians are pretty much want the Minsk agreement. Also, please take a note that there is no longer federalization. There is no longer veto, right? Essentially, what in the works is a maximum and special status autonomy, right, which doesn't have this. And I don't think it's going to happen, not in this parliament, right? What's going to happen is a decentralization. What's going to happen is maybe an election. What's going to happen, maybe they're coming more legitimate, not fully legitimate local representatives. Because essentially, what is failed state, for sure, it's Donbas. And that provides an increasing security problem for the Russians, right? Because now if you go to Rostov, these local mafia are, you know, dealing with their issues with RPGs. That's a kind of dangerous situation. They're, you know, they have these soldiers on both sides. And for the Russians, this is also a security threat. Like, these people are coming back. They used to shoot policemen, so they shoot policemen in Moscow too, right? So, and the coast, the sanctions, you know, the refugees. There are 600,000 Ukrainian refugees in Russia and the other coast related with the obvious economic crisis, the financial economic crisis which Russia faces. So when you put together, Russia's interest should be a normalization of ties with Ukraine as much as possible. Obviously, it's not going to be fully possible. So this is how I see it. I know it's a kind of minority opinion because most of the people see that, you know, the Russians are slicing up. I just don't see it in this way. So I think there is a hope. The question is not that. The question is how the reintegration, you know, possible for the Ukrainian public and the elite, because Ukraine is Donbas, is they Donbas stolen our victory in the Maidan. And these people need to be punished, right? For a good reason or bad reason. It's a kind of very strong emotion. 6,000 people died
right? It was clearly an armed resistance, whether we call it terrorism or not, right? It was clearly Russia behind it, or aided. So there is a lot of resentment by a lot of Ukrainians. If you take a look at the polls, it's 50-50 pretty much. Most Ukrainians want peace, they don't want fighting anymore. But they knew the taking reintegration of the Donbas, it's a very painful pill to swallow at this stage.
Andrew, I just wanted to tag on the sanctions. I think the key problem we're facing is that as the German initiative to create the semi-legitimate political authorities in the East comes to fruition, we'll see. I mean, we may be on the eve of this October 2nd Paris meeting. We may see some kind of deal on creation of a pathway for political legitimacy for the rebels. That the Germans have overpromised the Russians the possibility of sanctions relief. And so just as, Balazs is saying there's a problem where the government of Ukraine overpromises, I fear that the chancellor may have overpromised the Russians. And so the Russian incentive to play ball may go down. Mm-hmm. And so there's we keep thinking that Putin is the far end of the political extreme in Russia. I don't think he is. In many respects, he's more of a moderate. And there are plenty of true believers who think Putin is possibly going to sell out the rebels. Putin is not really in this fight. It wants to keep a door open to the West, wants to be taken seriously. And there are a lot of people, think of Russia as like a submarine. There are a lot of people who just want to bring the hatch down and bring the submarine underwater. And I think that's the thing that's most dangerous over the next 2 months, 3 months.
One more thought on that, because I think it's very important to realize the sanctions were not coming because of Ukraine. The sanctions were coming because of the Malaysian plane. Because of the Malaysian plane. The European sanctions were introduced, the real ones, not the visa ban and asset freeze, but the real ones, right? The sectoral sanctions. Mm-hmm. Now, the Dutch are going to just issue the report. And what exactly is going to be in the report? Obvious Russian engagement, right? I don't think, also the logical reason why I don't think that it was a Russian crew, simply because a Russian crew would know what they shoot. And because the book works in a way that it's easy to shoot, it's just boom. It's the sophistication comes through the radar, that you know what you shoot. And that's what, for me, it's leading to a rebel commando with a book, whether Russian or Ukrainian, probably Russian, because there's enough evidence that it was Russian. So after this report, there is no way the European public will support the sanctions, or the Dutch can go and not veto it, or the Brits. So I think, it's an overpromise by Merkel. So sanctions are going to stay, I think, for a reasonably long time.
I just wanted to ask how you see...
Can you introduce yourself?
Oh, yes. I'm Alison Cole. I work on the International Justice Team at the Justice Initiative. I just wanted to ask how you see the referral to the International Criminal Court playing out in this context. I've been working on these issues for about 15 years now, and I've never seen such a confrontational referral as was written. It specifically highlighted the senior leadership of the Russian government, and it called the proxy armies terrorist groups. So it's pretty strong language in my space, and I'm curious to see how you see that play out.
You want to take that?
I just think we're headed for stalemate on these referrals. I think that the Russians, particularly when the Netherlands indictments come out, will refuse to render anyone to Dutch justice, and we'll be in a similar kind of standoff as we've been on the Litvinenko case, where the Russians will game the system, will play in the... I'm not a lawyer, but I would think we'll just game the national jurisdiction procedure to get as much discovery, and we've seen this movie before. And I just can't see how ICTI gets jurisdiction, but maybe something I don't know. I mean, I think.
I also think that just because of the language, it's just not going to happen. If it's essentially was drafting to support Ukraine, and because it's taken their vocabulary, but it's very much, fair enough. The Ukrainians are the victims here, clearly, but that's just not going to work in this way.
I agree with Andrew, but I should say that the foundation has been quite integrally involved with the ICC in helping with its various civil society partners who were on the Maidan, provide evidence and testimony, and the law program coordinator, I don't know if you've been in touch with, you clearly have. Okay, enough said. Okay.
I mean, aside from whether or not it results in arrests and transfers, I was also curious to see what you think it's going to do in terms of the geopolitics there. I mean, also thinking about Georgia and how that's also an ICC investigation directed at Russia, and there'll be some movement probably in both these situations in November. So often we have to take into consideration how the justice track, even if it doesn't result in activity in the courtroom, will be utilized within the conversations you're having. I was kind of surprised there weren't more reactions, let's say.
Other comments or questions? Tanya.
Others should go first.
Yeah, oh, Dana, please.
This kind of takes it back to the reform situation within Ukraine, but...
Dana works on the Eurasia program.
I work with the Eurasia program. So you've mentioned the tangible reforms that have been carried out in terms of the legal system, in terms of the police, et cetera, but as we know, informal politics play a huge role in Ukraine. And so in terms of political behaviors and reforming those informal systems, how have the reforms that have been passed or have been thought of being passed translated to that behavior? Do we see any indicators that the informal networks and political behaviors have been changed or have a chance at being changed, or is it much of the same again in Ukraine?
That's a very good question, and it's complicated to answer. I do think that, well, first of all, the implementation is lagging behind the legislative work, right? When we see implementation essentially working, it's like the policy thing. Again, the gas, the energy, and transportation, and these kind of things. That's where the most visible, you know, when the implementation comes in. I also be emphasizing that, you know, what we're trying to monitor is not a legislative monitor, like how many laws are passed. You know, that's not that important as essentially this. Now, when it comes to, you know, again, you see various patterns, and I think it's a good news that you already see, like I mentioned, this new minority. A certain minority behaves differently within the government, particularly in these new institutions, which Alexander has mentioned as well, you know, and that gets a lot of media attention, which is a very positive process. What you don't get the media attention is what the rest is doing, right? And the rest is pretty much the old paternalistic, you know, and in a very bad situation, because, you know, like, if you used to make like $600-$700, let's say, as a government official, now you're making $150. Right? Essentially, your basic security is now is question, or the security of your family. How are you going to feed your kids? Right? So this situation is, I believe, is very important to highlight and very dangerous. Like, unless there is going to be a bit more focus on helping out the Ukrainians in this situation, right? That's resistance toward reforms and toward that minority is likely to grow. It was a very good interview with Yarisko. Maxim Aristavi was doing it, I don't know for which magazine, and he described his way to get to Yarisko's office. And essentially, you have this little island in the ministry which pretty much functions in the same way, right? So how, and this is what, like, so reforms need this kind of coalition building instead of, I will order reforms to be happen, right? Like convincing people, educating the public, you know, the reform communication and education is essentially as much important, you know, as the, so I another example for that, there are 250,000 policemen at this stage in Ukraine, right? All have weapons. Most of them have been engaged in criminal activities. So what are they going to do? So there is a risk, right? And I think here comes the government thinking to give them pension, to give them something, right, that these people can, if not restart their life, but at least kind of have a normal, decent living without the criminal activity, right? It's tremendously important, the social aspect of this. And the second, they're increasing, the government has increased 4 times the gas price, right? And I think the international community can come in and saying, okay, we're going to pay for the meters for the people, for individual households, because that's essentially something which is going to help people to take the responsibility for their own. You know, like, we have generations who didn't really care about the gas bill, right? And now suddenly they cannot afford it, right? So help them to save. It's education. It's the technical tool to get the meter for their households, right? Which is going to essentially make that change, that shift, that mental shift happen.
What about when it comes to regional administrations? Like you mentioned earlier about Saakashvili and the fact that he has not been able, because of his PR, to make the allies in Odessa that he needs in order to be successful ultimately or to stay there for a long period of time. So how do you change those patterns of behavior as well in order to have a reform-minded governor of a region be able to actually enact reforms and follow them through with a popular mandate, despite not making those network connections in a region that has those informal patronal networks in existence?
Pretty much the same way. You have, there's actually a reform task force now, or supposed to be, I don't know which the stage and implementation, I've seen some reports about that, at the regional administration. So these, you know, there are these cells, you know, of New Ukraine, if you like, who are essentially should be taking care of this work. But it's a question whether they have the authority, you know, what authority they're working with, and the second one, that they have the skills to educate, you know, explain, engage, and essentially some budget support to also pay where, you know, the kind of the social situation needs to be kept. Now, again, these are minority things, right? These are few people in the system which still are kind of operate in the same way. The other thing is the regional feuding. You know, essentially there are new power groups because of the weapons, because of the security situation, either for hire or by own ambition. And that's what we've seen in Mukachevo, right? When the private sector starts shooting the old police because I'm working for this and they're working for that, and then what? Right, so these kind of situations, I think, there was a lot of business disputes similar, just without the shooting, but weapons, security engaged and all this, takeovers. So there's a lot of regional feuding. Those regional landlords who were kind of taking for granted are not necessarily will be. So we're going to see a lot of that. And then the Kiev region relationships, whether it's going to be for Poroshenko agreeing with Kerness in Kharkiv, which essentially happened just last week. You know, also it's happening because Kerness is very popular. It's 49%.
This is the mayor of Kharkiv.
You know, and you know, but I think a very unfortunate but very realistic pattern of this behavior is what happened in Chernigov at the by-election to the Rada. Just quick summary: 129 candidates originally, which in the ended up between two, Dnipropetrovsk Kolomoisky's right-hand Korban and Poroshenko's MP Berezenko. None of them are from Chernigov, right? Berezenko is a former party of the region official, right? Co-opted now by Poroshenko, and because the president must win, he won. It doesn't sound like in the Ukraine, but these elements are also in play. You know, we cannot dismiss that this is not happening. This is happening, and we need to put our work, the reforms, and all this, with the notion that we are the minority. I'm an ethnic minority, so kind of for me it's okay. But for most of the donors are not. They're still thinking, you know, coming from Washington or to New York, that they're doing what we think they should. No. These people living in their own local.
Sasha, do you want to respond to anything?
I may add. First of all, there is a this question put us to the substance of the what. Which reforms may provide the changes in behavior? And in sectoral terms, yes, we may say that we have some new policemen, or maybe we'll have some new prosecutors, and then we'll hope again to have adopted legislation for civil service reform as well, and once we'll have new service. But generally, everything is based on the people's capacity to participate and to also to manage the situation. And here we have one substantial reform because usually when we discuss decentralization, we refer to Minsk implementation, to Donbass, and whatever. However, the real substance is not in the constitution, but in the legislation which was adopted this spring about the self-governed local communities. So there is a legislation which empowers communities for the real self-governance on voluntary basis. So this is a kind of the trap. So there is a proposal on behalf of the central government to local people. This is an instrument, you may use it on voluntary basis. We don't force you to use it. If you use it, you will have growth of your status within the governance, and then growth of your budget and everything. But in return, you need to change the very style of behavior, because in order to work, they need to expand their operational capacity on local level, and this is not an easy task. So this is kind. You need to train the entire population, or at least the most active part of the population, to be responsible. And as an outcome, after half year of implementation, we have 7% of local territorial communities passed through this model. So this is the result of this voluntary process, when this local community take responsibility, and they will go for local election in October based on this new regulation. So there will be a transitional period where this new regulation works, but only for those who voluntarily used this instrument. And in my view, this is much more substantial than what is usually discussed. But what we usually discussed, and this new position of prefects, or this new composition of local councils, which is widely discussed, but it is less substantial, in my opinion. What is more substantial is really this way towards sustainable local communities. But it will definitely take longer, because this is even if in the more developed societies, these reforms take some time. So I think that there will be one of the most substantial reforms, because empowering local community, you build the real democracy, functional democracy, and then there will other levels will follow.
Okay, we can stay informally. This has been hugely enlightening, and Balázs, thank you for being here, and Andrew as well, Sasha as always. George, anything else? Okay, thank you.